For more information, call 352-8200. Today's broadcast is made possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Real Meets the Imagined, Northwest Coast Art, Claude Lévi-Strauss, and Surrealist by Marie Mosé, George A. Miller Endowment Visiting Professor, UIUC and Senior Researcher, CNRS, Laboratory of Social Anthropology, Paris, on Thursday, March 31st at 7:30 p.m. at Knight Auditorium in Spurlock Museum. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located on the lower level, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. From the time that we are young, we are advised not to make snap decisions. We're told that we should take our time, we should think carefully about things, we should gather as much data and information as we can, and as the decision becomes more important, we are told we should take more and more time. However, that is not always the case that snap decisions are bad. In fact, sometimes decisions made quickly can be every bit as good as decisions made cautiously and deliberately. So writes our guest for this part of Focus 580, Malcolm Gladwell. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and has been at the magazine since 1996. He has a relatively new book out now that's getting a lot of attention. The title of his book is Blink: The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. It's published by Little Brown, and it looks at rapid cognition and how it is that some people seem to be very good at this. And in fact, he makes the argument in the book that for anyone, you can learn to be better at this kind of rapid decision making. And he discusses it in the book. We'll be talking about it this morning with Malcolm Gladwell, and we're pleased to have him joining us by telephone. Let me tell you just a little bit more about him. As I said, he's been working for The New Yorker since 1996. He has written about many different subjects at the magazine. An article that he wrote back in 1996, The Tipping Point, was expanded into a book titled The Tipping Point: How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. That was published in 2000, is now available in paper, and is continuing to sell very briskly. In 2001, his profile of Ron Popeil, the pitchman, was awarded the National Magazine Award for Profiles before going to work at The New Yorker. He worked at The Washington Post, where he was a staff writer, and first worked in the business section and then later as a science reporter. Questions are welcome, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, if you're interested in joining the conversation, you can do that. We just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many people as possible. But of course, anyone's welcome to call. Mr. Gladwell, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm very well.
You look to be like you're on about the most grueling tour schedule I have ever seen. you're making an awful lot of stops.
Well, you know, I think the best analogy is not to a writer, but to a kind of bad indie rock band. Driving around in an old bus.
Do you have T-shirts and jackets here with Blink on them?
I wish.
All right. Well, anyway, I much appreciate you talking with us.
No.
The book is full of examples of people who are very good at making these kind of decisions. And I'm sure we can talk about a number of them. But maybe we'd start with the example that you give right at the beginning. This has to do with a statue which had been purchased by the folks at the Getty Museum in California. And it was offered for them for an awful lot of money. And if it was what it said it was, the person who was offering it said it was, it would have been a great treasure. And they wanted to, you know, it was a lot of money they were talking about. So they wanted to make sure that it was what they thought it was. And they had it tested out. And experts said, yeah, sure, go ahead. However, then once when it got on display and some people who were art authorities started to look at it, something happened. So you can take up the story from there.
Yeah, the Getty had spent months, I mean a year, analyzing the statue, using every conceivable, sophisticated scientific mode of analysis until they were sure it was real. that was, in fact, 2,500 years old. And they bought it for $10 million. And right after they bought it, they brought by a couple of art experts, people who really knew ancient Greek sculpture, to come and see it because they were really proud of it. And these experts walked in, took one look at the statue, and instantly just said, it's wrong. It's fake. You know, they just kind of blurted it out. And this happened repeatedly to the Getty, to the point where they began to get really, you know, concerned and spent $10 million on this thing. And I like that story because it's this classic showdown between two ways of thinking. One is the kind of deliberate, conscious, you know, do every test you can, look at all the data kind of thinking. And the other is you take someone who has real expertise in an area and you just have them, you just ask for their gut instinct. And the gut instinct said one thing and the sort of deliberate, conscious decision-making said another. And the people who had the gut instinct about it were right. It was a fake. It's pretty clear now. And if you look in the Getty catalog now, it says, you know, this is a Kouros statue. It says Getty Kouros, either 26th century BC or 1975.
And they were stuck with it. They couldn't get their $10 million back?
They couldn't get their $10 million back. But, you know, so there are certain kinds of situations and certain kinds of people where more can be known in the blink of an eye than can be known after months and months of research. But the important thing there is certain kinds of situations and certain kinds of people. It is not true for all of us. And the real project of the book is to try and figure out what are those instances where these kinds of instinctive decisions work.
We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Malcolm Gladwell about his recent book, Blink. What we need to do here, we're going to do a little transmitter maintenance work, so we need to pause for just a second. We'll be right back. And there we are. This is AM 580 WILL Urbana. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us on the program this morning. Malcolm Gladwell is our guest. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, there in this particular case, the people at the Getty, it would seem, did everything right. And they had people come in bring to bear modern technology and, all due diligence. And it seemed that they were very cautious and they got this answer. So then they brought people in, these people who spend all of their time actually looking at the works and thinking about them and absorbing them in perhaps a subconscious way or in some sort of different way. And they came up with this different answer. So they said right away, they said, no, there's something wrong with this. So there, I guess the question is now for these people like Thomas Hoving and these other folks who looked at the statue and immediately said, no, what were they doing? What was going on there in their heads that was so different from the people that were pursuing this different kind of avenue, the scientific avenue, where they scraped little bits off the statue and they did chemical analysis and did, you know, everything that you could think about doing and came up with the wrong answer?
Well, what happened, I think, what happens there is that our instincts are the kind of fruit of experience. And psychologists, when they describe these kinds of instinctive judgments, what we're really talking about is stuff that comes from our unconscious. And psychologists sort of talk about our unconscious being a kind of giant computer, and which gathers data from our life. And in this case, these people had spent a lifetime thinking about, talking about, learning about, touching, watching, feeling, observing sculpture. And their database on sculpture was enormous. And so when they looked at this thing, they were able to, compare what they were seeing in front of them with a lifetime of learning and do this kind of instinctive, did what they were looking at match what they knew to be real about and true about sculpture? And that's what was, that's the kind of question you can only really answer instinctively, because they were sort of getting at the gestalt of this statue in front of them. And they were trying to, or another way of saying is that they were, what you do when you look at a piece of sculpture in that situation is you put yourself in the mind of the artist and you ask yourself, is this mind contemporary or is this mind 2,600 years old? And they put themselves in that moment in the mind of the person who created that sculpture and they said, it's a contemporary mind, right? And that's, you know, like, so you can't use a computer and you can't use X-ray chromatography and you can't use all these other tools to answer that question. You can answer other questions with those kinds of mechanisms, but you can't get at this sort of the question of something's essence. And that, to me, is a beautiful example of a situation where our instinctive judgments are the only way we have means available for getting it the right answer. Yeah.
And one of the things that I think it's interesting that you argue, and I'm sure other people who study this argue, is that we are talking about a process of thinking here. It's not, I think if you hear a story like that,
yeah,
you imagine that what these people are doing is that they're operating out of I don't know what.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for example, for that we have a common expression we call gut feeling. They went with their emotions. And somehow by applying words like that, it makes it sound like this is not about thinking, it's about something else. And you're making the argument, no, in fact, it is thinking. It may happen very fast, but it is thinking.
Yeah, this is one of the ideas I wanted to combat in the book. I think one of the ways in which we denigrate rapid cognition is by pretending it's not cognition, mm-hmm. by just saying, just as you said, that it's feeling. It's a kind of, it comes from some woolly, weird, non-rigorous place. You know, the phrase, it's no coincidence, I think, that we've, for years and years, have used the phrase women's intuition, which is a way of denigrating this kind of decision-making by saying it's women's, that, you know, it's the sort of thing that women do. It's men came up with that phrase, I think, to put down that way of reaching decisions. It's very, very clear to me that it's not some, that this is not some emotional, non-rigorous thing. It is thinking that follows some of the very same rules as conscious, deliberate thinking, except that it happens a lot faster, and we don't know what's going on in that moment, right? Mm. The guys who looked at the sculpture and said, there's something wrong with that, couldn't identify what they thought was wrong with it. That could only come later. You know, the kind of gut feeling they had, gut reaction they had, happened so quickly they had no kind of access to their reasons for jumping to that conclusion. And that's what's hard about this kind of thinking, because we're so used to the notion of being able to understand why we make the decisions we make. And we can't do that with our instinctive thinking.
Mm-hmm. Going back to sort of this idea that I was talking about when we introduced it, that we're told when you make a decision, the more information you have, the more data you have, the better.
Yeah.
And I think also what you argue for in this book is, in fact, what we find out is that, first of all, that we're capable of making good decisions with less data. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that may be better. That may lead to better decisions to limit the amount mm-hmm. and maybe make sure that the kind of information you give to somebody when they're making their decision is key. Maybe there are certain sorts of things, mm-hmm. but that in fact more information, more data, generally speaking, does not lead to a better decision.
Yeah, this is a big theme of Blink. Because, you know, if you think back to the case of this sculpture, the Getty Museum spends a year analyzing the sculpture and generates reams and reams and reams of data. In fact, they published an article in Scientific American saying how sure they are that the sculpture is real. The art experts look at it for 2 seconds. So one side has got an enormous amount of information. One side has only the thinnest sliver of information. And yet it's the side that has less information that's right. And that is something that's profoundly characteristic of our instinctive decisions, and that is that they are their accuracy and their sophistication is not dependent on the kind of volume of information that goes into the decision. In fact, one of the themes I explore in the book is that one of the ways to help people make better snap decisions is often to take away information from them. I talk a lot about medical decision making, about how one way to make doctors into much better decision makers, snap decision makers, about chest pain, trying to predict whether someone's having a heart attack, mm-hmm. is to limit the amount of information they have about the patient. And by limiting it, you allow them to kind of see the pattern and not get overwhelmed with data. And it's this, you know, I think that we have this kind of inflexible notion when it comes to thinking that in all cases, it is always better to use the maximum amount of information in order to make a decision. And that's just not true.
Well, we have several people here who would like to get in on the conversation, and I guess we should do that. We'll go to the phones, and again, though, maybe I'll just very quickly introduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Malcolm Gladwell. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and has been there since 1996. His newest book is titled Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, published by Little Brown, which indeed makes his argument, as we have explained, that contrary to often what we are told, it is sometimes the case that quickly made decisions, snap judgments, can be pretty good. Of course, they can also be bad. Maybe we'll get into that as well. There are, we could say some things about why it is that sometimes they can be good and they can be bad, but indeed sometimes they can be good. And that's the theme of the book. It is out now available in the bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have several, starting with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm a retired editor, once of books in New York City at McGraw-Hill for 6 years. And finally, Research Magazine here on campus. Frequently in editing, as the author probably knows, you have to make quick decisions.
Mm-hmm.
At McGraw especially, you dealt with out-of-town printers, and often, surprisingly, well, I once said, some book I was working on, my God, this is like working in the New York Times newsroom,
mm-hmm.
because we'd made, had to make, right on the dot, a decision, or else, you know, the schedule would suffer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you'd lose money. You already had a production schedule lined up with your printer. If you didn't make it, you got charged.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, I'd say also, getting to the more practical world, I can remember two times in my life, two stand out. One was recently here at the Barnes & Noble bookstore. Soon after Christmas, when there are a lot of books on sale, and partly my New York experience helped me with this, but I was absorbed in reading a book, you know, a great discount, and I felt I have kind of a tote bag type purse, and I go back and forth on that, having lived in the city. And anyway, some woman came up very close to me, and I could feel the purse kind of jiggle. It reminded me of theft I experienced on the New York subway. And so I just stepped to one side and held my purse closer, and she kind of smiled and moved away. Another time was about 20 years ago when my children were young, and I lived here in Champaign, Urbana. And the horn on my car, I had an international travel haul, kind of like a pickup truck with an RV back in. And I was taking, it was a very hot day, and I was taking my children to the swimming pool. And a man was coming from the opposite direction. He was almost in the middle of the street. And I thought, oh, my God, the horn won't work. I can't. He was looking at a woman who was scantily clad walking across the park. And I thought, how in the world? Our horn does it. What are we going to do? And so I told the kids, I said, yell as loud as you can. And we all yelled. And right at the last minute, he moved aside.
Mm-hmm. No, it's interesting. You, what you're talking about is that in our daily lives, we use this mode of thinking, this mode of very, very instinctively and rapidly making decisions, far more, I think, than we care to admit. I mean, I think one of the things that intrigued me in writing this book was when you talk to people about instinctive judgments, their initial sense is, that's sort of love at first sight, or it's impulse buying in a grocery store. They sort of think it's marginal and isolated.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the more you examine the way that human beings think, the more you realize that we use this mode, this instinctive rapid cognition mode, all the time. In fact, it's a central part of what it means to be make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We can't function without it. And that's what once you understand the centrality, I think it becomes enormously important to understand what the kind of rules are of this kind of thinking. How to make it better, how to understand when we do it badly, and when to appreciate it for as sort of the best guide we have to making a good decision.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it is Mother Nature.
Yeah. No, there's a
going back to caveman days.
Yeah.
You had to think fast.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have some others. Let's go on and talk with someone next. This is also someone in Champaign in line number two. Hello.
Yeah. Thank you. A couple of questions. One, in your research, did you look at all at martial artists who actively develop the ability for making these kinds of snap decisions or rapid cognition, which is very important in terms of fighting skills?
Mm-hmm.
And also, are you familiar with the writings of Gary Zukav?
No, I'm not actually.
He writes about intuition quite a bit and multi-sensory perception.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems very closely related to the kind of thing you're talking about, and
yeah,
the importance in to be able to develop those mm-hmm. skills, that you have to be very aware of what's going on inside you, and
yeah,
to understand what's outside you, you have to focus inside.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. One of the really fascinating things is, in absolutely every field, every kind of discipline, there is a word or a concept or a kind of scholarship around this kind of thinking. So, for example, if you talk to people who are something as far from martial arts as you can get, people who are birders, they all talk about this concept of jizz. Which is that once you begin to become a very accomplished birder, it becomes possible to identify a bird just with the briefest of glance, without really knowing why you think a bird is a particular type or variety or species. You just know, right? Or if you talk to in the world of military, there's a concept called coup d'oeil, which is the word they use to describe military generals who have this ability to make sense of a battlefield at a glance. All of the great generals in history have been said to have great coup d'oeil. Napoleon had been, Wellington, Patton. These are all people who have, and you're talking about it in the context of karate, but, what's interesting is that in every discipline, in every facet of life where there is a demand for complex decision-making, and martial arts has, as you well know, demands complex decision-making, people have to, the very best people, develop the ability to make those kinds of decisions instantaneously. I think that's one of the kind of profoundly interesting things about this mode of thinking.
Well, and for instance, Tai Chi Chuan, they actually talk about the concept of responding but doing it first, in that you move, I move first.
Yeah.
In other words, before they're even actually are able to move, you've already understood what they're going to do, and you're already ahead of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it is amazing what the human brain, with adequate training, what the brain is capable of doing. And it's really remarkable how quickly and how well we can make decisions under those kinds of high pressure, in those kinds of high pressure situations.
Well, it may be more than the brain, but thank you very much.
All right, yeah. Thanks for the call. To take the example that you gave about the birders,
mm-hmm.
I think we can understand that if someone was experienced and had seen a lot of birds, that with a quick glance, you could tell a bird based on, first of all, the sort of habitat, because you know which kind of birds you would expect in a certain place, but then things like, their general shape, their color, and then a few key markings or features that you would look at, and
yeah,
we'd get to the point where, on a particular, if you see three or four things and you can take that in very quick, then you know, okay, that's what that is. So in here's a case, that's a case though where the key markings are sort of unmistakable. I mean, they're that reliable. The problem seems to be is that sometimes, you know, you talked earlier about the fact that it's actually maybe you can make better decisions by having less information, mm-hmm. and having some key points of information. Although the problem is that sometimes if we do that, the key points we're using are somehow, they're wrong. They're actually not indicators.
Yeah.
I guess I'm thinking of the Warren Harding error, mm-hmm. where we take something as being indicative of something when it's not like, you know, if the bird has the mark over the eye, well, that's a particular kind of bird. Well, to take the example that you give in that chapter, just because someone's tall,
yeah,
doesn't mean they're going to be a good leader. So, I mean, how do you sort the good markers from the bad markers?
Yeah, this is a big theme of the book, which is, you know, all right, this kind of thinking is central to the way we make sense of the world. But it also clearly, there are moments when we are led badly astray mm-hmm. by this kind of thinking. And what goes on when we're led astray is what you're talking about, that we seize on the wrong cues and jump to conclusions based on those cues. I mean, what is racial discrimination? But rapid cognition gone awry, right? It's you look at someone and you draw an inference based on the color of their skin, which is a totally unfair and erroneous inference, right? That's what we. And there's a case where this kind of thinking has led us astray. And so as I try in the book, in Blink, to kind of identify instances where, try to figure out, well, what are the reasons why we would be led astray by certain kinds of situations. I mean, you mentioned what I call the Warren Harding error, which is, I have a chapter on the strange story of Warren Harding, who, you know, was our best-looking president by far. Tall, incredibly handsome, distinguished, rumbly voice, piercing blue eyes, you know, lantern jaw. And he rose from an obscure, you know, he was an obscure local politician in Ohio to the White House on the strength of his looks, on the fact that he just, everyone looked at him and said, oh my goodness, what a, you know, this man looks like a president. And then he became president, and we all suddenly realized that he was a numbskull. I mean, he was the dumbest man to ever occupy the White House. And there's a case where we couldn't get past that kind of snap judgment. We saw this guy. We made this sort of snap judgment. He's huge. You know, he's exactly what we want in a leader. And we never really scraped past that surface to understand that he was, in fact, wholly unqualified. And so we have to be careful with these kinds of judgments as well. We have to make sure that, just why I always come back to the notion in the book of experience, that what experience in a given field gives you is the ability to get past those surface snap judgments and make a snap judgment based on something that's more meaningful. And that's why I think it's really only people with experience who ought to trust this kind of thinking. Mm.
We have someone else to talk with. Let's go to line number 3, and this caller is in Urbana. Hello.
There's a person who deals with personal security, Gavin DeBecker.
Oh, yes. I talked to him in Blink, yeah.
The Gift of Fear, and he talks about using the sorts of things we're talking about to mm-hmm. in self-protection. A friend of mine were in a store once, and she saw a man, and something about him, he preceded us out the door. When we went out the door, she said, I'm going across the street.
Mm-hmm.
And he worries me. I didn't see anything wrong. But I, having read his book, I thought, nope, she's picking up on something I haven't seen. And after we got across the street, I said, now, can you tell me what specifically
mm-hmm.
it was now that we're away from him? And so by then she could pinpoint some things that raised red flags for her about his behavior.
Yeah.
But I, having read his book, I just said to myself, well, it's not going to hurt anything to do this. And oftentimes, I know that women in particular, we want to be polite, and we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and we don't pay attention to those things. At the same time, I was reading in a newspaper from this week about serial killers and this BTK killer, and they were talking about how serial killers can often have disguises, masks that make them invisible to the most of us. One woman who is a who writes about serial killers and was a former police officer was working as a volunteer at a crisis telephone line,
mm-hmm.
and the person who was sitting next to her, a young man, would walk her at 4 a.m. to her car and always tell her to be careful, and turned out to be Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
Ted Bundy, and she had no clue that this was a serial killer who was walking her to her car at 4 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who have written things about the kinds of ways that we make mistakes in our rapid cognition. There are certain kinds of things that we tend to do that trip up. Is it Tversky? Is that the name of one of the people who's done that?
Yes, Kahneman and Tversky are two people who studied a lot of this. It's funny you mentioned De Becker, Gavin De Becker. I had a long conversation with him when I was writing my book. And I have there's a whole chunk from him in one of the chapters. But he said something really interesting to me, which I've never forgotten, which is he said, parents, always warn their children, never speak to strangers. But he said, the problem with that is that unless you speak to strangers as a child, you don't learn the difference between a friendly stranger and a dangerous stranger. So he says, make your children speak to strangers when you're around. When you're with them, introduce them to strangers, have them talk to strangers. It is only by building up some kind of knowledge about people who are unfamiliar that a child will develop good instinctive judgments about who's a potential threat and who isn't. I thought that was really, really interesting that, because what he was saying was that we're not born with the instinct to tell the difference between someone who's dangerous and someone who's not. We have to acquire it. And some of us acquire it quite quickly. I mean, you talked about your friend who could spot someone, and you didn't pick up those same cues. Some of us acquire those skills quite quickly. Some of us don't. But what we need to do is to understand that that is a skill that needs to be acquired. And we need to help children learn that. And that means giving them exposure to strangers, controlled exposure, but still exposure to strangers. And he really worries that parents have taken this notion about not speaking to strangers too far and haven't understood that when a child is in a safe situation, it's a really good idea for them to get to know, to go up and talk to people who are unfamiliar.
Well, and a lot of people will tell you that they, from personal experience now, that the people who turned out to be the most dangerous were people that they knew.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's often true in the case for children in particular who view familiar adults as adults to be trusted, and they turn out to be the ones who are the abusers or the rapists or whatever. I think he's also written a book about protecting children. And his point is not that we should be paralyzed by fear, but that we should develop tools for evaluating situations so that we're not fearful all the time.
Yeah,
I thought that was very good. Thanks, and I'm going to look for your book.
Right,
well,
good, thank you.
For the call. Well, let me introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Malcolm Gladwell. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and during the time he's been at the magazine, has written articles on a lot of different sorts of things. One of them, titled "The Tipping Point," was expanded into a book. And continues to be popular. A lot of people find it interesting. It's available in paperback now. It first came out in 2000. His new book is Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. It's published by Little Brown. Before going to work at The New Yorker, Malcolm Gladwell worked for The Washington Post. He was a staff writer there, worked in the business section, and later on as a science reporter. He's now spending some time traveling around the country talking about Blink, and in fact, later this week, will be in Chicago. This will be on Thursday. He'll be making an appearance at the Nancy Goldberg International Center in Chicago. That'll be on Thursday, 6 p.m., and this is open to the public. So if people are interested, people who can hear us in Chicago, you can do that. Stop by and see him. And of course, you can, if you want to read Blink, you can go down to the bookstore and look for the book. Questions are welcome here on the program, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have someone else here on our toll-free line. This is someone in Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I got a couple of questions. First, about the story that you told at the top of the program about those experts that quickly use their intuition quickly to determine that the statue that the museum had paid a lot of money for was fake.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, did anyone ever investigate? Certainly, they had paid all this money. Did they ever investigate the actual cues? Obviously, those experts were picking up something that wasn't metaphysical. And if you had investigated deeply enough, you would probably actually find some distinct difference in those statues that they were actually picking up. Did anyone ever discover what that difference was?
Well, this is what's interesting about our instinctive judgments, and that it's really, really, really hard to know what we're using to make these decisions. And that's, you can certainly ask people, and I call up all the experts who looked at it and said, well, what was it that tipped you off? And they said, I don't know. And you can't know because, think about it, these judgments are coming from our unconscious. They're coming from a part of our brain that's closed off to us. We can make hypotheses. One of them, Thomas Hoving, said, he thinks that maybe what he struck him as weird was the color of the statue. That it, you know, a statue like this was supposed to have been in the ground for 2,500 years. And he'd seen lots of things that had been in the ground for 2,500 years, and this didn't look like it was one of them. It looked like it had come out of the ground, you know, 5 years ago. But he's not sure. I mean, that's sort of one of the possibilities. But you can never really know for sure why you're making... it's like asking someone, if you fall in love with a woman, if you're a man, and I ask you, well, why did you... What is it specifically about, you know, this woman that's led you to fall in love? Do you really know? I mean, you might have a vague idea, but at the end of the day, it's something ephemeral. It's something really hard to describe. And that's what we're talking about. That's what's really frustrating about these kinds of decisions to many people is that we're not really very good at describing precisely where they come from.
Well, let me suggest a cause, possibly, of what we call woman's intuition.
Mm-hmm.
In your study, did you ever run into the fact that women have a lot more, their left brain communicates with their right brain a lot better than male brains do.
Yeah.
Have you run into that?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is a very interesting topic about to what extent do male and female thinking patterns differ. I'm not crazy about it. I tend to think that the biggest difference between men and women is not how they think, but how they explain their thinking. And women are simply a lot more willing to own up to when they're making instinctive judgments than men are. Men like to pretend that when they're making an instinctive judgment, they're not. That's not to say there aren't legitimate differences between the way men and women think, but I worry sometimes that we exaggerate those.
Well,
and that, you know, we have a lot more in common than in the way we think than we have, and that is different. That's just my personal opinion.
There is an actual physical explanation for the fact that the female right brain and the left brain communicate better than the male right brain and left brain, and that is that at about the eighth week of gestation, when you're still a baby, you're still in the womb, male babies get their brains get a testosterone bath.
Yeah.
And it breaks the communication cord between the left brain and the right brain is called the corpus callosum.
Yeah.
And that corpus callosum is, how should we say, it's partly broken in the male brain. It's not in the female brain. They really do have physically more communication between the left brain and the right brain. And I know psychologists who say that's the reason they have that intuition.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Yeah, thank you.
No, good program.
All
thank
right,
you.
Thank you. Well, thanks for the call. I guess thinking back, though, on this whole business, that particular business of the brain structure and the difference between men and women, I do recall that at least one study making that argument was based on a very small number of individuals, and it's the kind of thing that you can really only do post-mortem. And I guess I remember thinking back on this that some people looked at it and said, well, in fact, you have to remember that there's a lot of variability between one person and another, and you, in fact, can find as much variability between your average man and your average woman as you can between people of the same gender. So it's it's very difficult to look at physical brain structures and have enough look at enough of them to be able to draw much in the way of conclusions.
Yeah, I was much more interested in just this general question about what distinguishes between any two people, regardless of whether they're male or female. I didn't want to go down the male-female route because, like you said, it does get pretty tricky pretty fast.
Yeah. Certainly there are examples, particularly people who work in a particular area where they've got a lot of experience and a lot of training. So whether we're talking about the art expert, whether we're talking about a physician, whether we're talking about a psychologist, we could be talking about, I don't know, an athletic coach. I mean, we could be talking about all kinds of different things where people get to be in certain situations that's within their area of expertise and experience really good at this. Is there a way that you can, though, generalize from that and say, for your average person, in their daily life, can you help people to be better? They may not be as good as some of these people in their field, but can you take your average person on your average day and train them to be a better decision maker? Based on some of the stuff that you've learned at looking at these people who are really good at it.
I think so. You know, although before I answer the question, I'll say one caveat, which is Blink is not a book that gives, at the end, a kind of simple equation for how to be a better instinctive decision maker, for the simple reason that you can't come up with an equation like that. We're talking about the kind of thinking that comes from our unconscious, and this is an enormously complex field. And the unconscious is by definition unknowable, right? It's this, and many, many bigger minds than I have struggles, you know, with this question. So the best we could do is to kind of give people some guidelines for thinking, and that's what the book kind of does. So it's, for example, I spend a lot of time talking about the end of the book. I talk about what happened in the classical music world when they started to put up screens in auditions. And, you know, for years and years and years in classical music, nobody ever hired any women. And they thought it was because men were inherently better musicians than women were. And then they started to put up screens in auditions so you couldn't see the person who was auditioning, and all of a sudden they began to hire women. And what they realized belatedly after the fact was that they were making a snap judgment, and an audition is a snap judgment. You decide almost immediately whether someone's any good. That in a way they hadn't understood, their feelings about women had kind of biased their judgment. But when they put up the screen and they screened out the thing that was biasing them, their feelings about women, the knowledge that someone was a woman, they were able to make a good snap judgment again. And that says to me that, you know what, maybe we should be doing this a lot more in our everyday lives, is finding ways of filtering out the kind of information that that corrupts our snap decisions. You know, just to give one off the top of my head, I no longer believe that juries should be able to see the defendant in a criminal trial. I don't see how it helps at all. I think it only serves to introduce bias into the equation. Or I don't think that since writing this book, I've become a huge proponent of uniforms in public schools, just because I don't think the information that people gather in that split second, teachers gather in that split second about students based on the way students are dressed is helpful. I think it's another way in which bias enters into the system. And it would just be easier to take that kind of information off the table and just say, everyone's going to look the same in the way they dress, and let teachers make instinctive judgments based on other things that actually are central to the task of educating kids. So those are, you know, I would like us to kind of think about our world in that way, to sort of think, well, how can we restructure our environments to improve the quality of our snap decisions?
Let us talk with another caller. This is someone in Chicago, line number 4. Hello. Caller there on line 4, a toll-free line in Chicago. Yeah, go ahead.
Regarding the matter of perception, the story was reading about Helen Keller, that when somebody asked her, I can't think of anything worse than not being able to see anything. And she, Helen Keller replied, oh, yes, there is, not having vision. And we need a vision that can really grasp things, like you gave the example of a general being able to command a whole range of things in the field of perception in an instant. And yet today we go out of our way to get into all kinds of trouble, sometimes reacting as we in the blink of an eye or a twinkle of an eye. And yet we need people who can sort of stand back and not make a quick judgment and act upon it needlessly. I thought I'd mention that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's funny you mention, this question of sometimes we need to step back and have people who don't jump to conclusions like this. That's absolutely true. And it goes to this interesting point, which is that what we need to do, I think, is to do a better job of understanding when are snap judgments appropriate and when are they not. And I have a chapter, for instance, in the book that in Blink that talks about this war game the Pentagon did before going to war in Iraq, in which they basically played out they did a rehearsal of the U.S. versus Iraq. And in their rehearsal, the team playing Iraq won the war, which is really interesting. And so I had this long discussion with the guy who played Saddam Hussein in this war game and trying to figure out why he won. And he was very big on this point. He was like, you know, you've got to understand when is rational, conscious, deliberate, you know, data-driven thinking appropriate, and when is instinctive decision-making appropriate? And his thing was, before the war starts, you don't do any kind of instinctive thinking. You sit down and you're very, very clear. You take a step back and you analyze the data and you move cautiously and carefully. Once the shooting starts, you have to move to a very, very different kind of thinking. Then you have to rely on your instincts. And if you don't, you're in trouble because you can't move fast enough to respond to the kind of pace of war. But he was very clear, though, that there was a place for each kind of thinking. And to confuse the two and to assume that all thinking that we do follows the same rules and the same kind of guidelines and the same mode is a mistake. And I thought that was a really profound insight.
We have another one, another caller here somewhere in the Chicago area on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I had two incidents that I very much remember in my life. I was 18 years of age. I grew up in a very... close neighborhood, you know, and I was on a bus in Chicago. It was late at night, and I noticed this man. He was maybe in his 45 years of age or 50, and I just felt very suspicious. So I told the conductor. I said, "I'm going to act like I'm going to get off." I said, "I don't like the looks of that man." I said, "I'm going to act like I'm getting off in the back, but I'm going to get back on, you know."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Let him get off," so I did that, and sure enough, he got off, and I didn't really get off the bus, and I thought that was good. And I must have been about 35 or so. I was in this church, and this man sitting about 4 pews in front of me, I never saw him. I only saw the back of him. He was handsome. He was well-dressed. And he looked like he had money, conservatively. And I said to my family member, he looks like a con artist.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, after church, this same man pulled up with this fancy Lincoln Continental, picks up the minister and this other lady, and later on the minister told my sister, my family member, that he had borrowed this money from him, from the minister, and he never paid him back, and my family member, I found out, was renting to him a house. And I said, you're renting a house to him? This was before we knew that he had taken this money from the minister. And he wasn't paying rent. You know, he was still, he was going to and going to. I said, get rid of him immediately, you know. And sure enough, then we found out that, you know, the person was stiffed by the no rent. He never paid any rent, and he was there for about a year. So I think that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean it's clear that we know more than we know. I mean, that's one of the big lessons of Blink, is that we have a level of knowledge that's greater than our kind of conscious understanding. And that when we make instinctive judgments, what we're doing is we're drawing on that pool of kind of extra unknown knowledge. And that's why it's important to listen to those judgments, I think, because, like I said, they represent a level of sophistication that we may not be consciously aware of.
I think that we're just at the point we're going to have to stop here. There is certainly more in the book, so if you're interested in reading more on the subject, you should look for the book that we mentioned a couple of times. It's titled Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, published by Little Brown, by our guest Malcolm Gladwell. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's now traveling around the country and, in fact, will be in Chicago at Maxim's, the Nancy Goldberg International Center, 6 p.m. on Thursday this week. And it is open to the public, so anyone who is interested can stop by there. And, of course, if you want to read the book or his previous book, The Tipping Point, you can look for them in the bookstore or in the library. Thank you very much, Mr. Gladwell.
Thank you so much.
Programs here are made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat about diet, nutrition, and exercise. She joins us this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at prices on the Chicago Board of Trade. March wheat, $324.5, down $4.5. July, $339, down $4.5. March corn, $206.25, down $2.75. May, $214.25, down $2.75. July corn, $221.25, down $3. December corn, $235.75, that down $2.5. March beans, $6.13, down $9.75. May, $6.21, down $8.75. November, $6.14, down $4.75. March meal, $182.80, down $1.